I think it's because it's a hard subject to talk about, and people are worried about saying the wrong thing. And it's very easy to say the wrong thing, because for everybody, depression is different. Postnatal depression is different.
Have you had much experience of people saying the wrong thing?
Yes, very much so. Well, one of the things that people used to say a lot was, oh, you must be loving it. This is your dream come true, you know. And I just thought, I don't know what I feel, because the thing about depression is that you don't feel anything. There is no feelings attached. So you don't actually feel depressed. You don't actually feel sad. You don't feel happy. That there is no feelings at all.
You just feel numb.
You just feel really numb and very lost, very isolated, and particularly as a new mum, with everything that a new baby brings as well, getting out the house is hard enough.
You're telling me.
Without having the added depression, you don't know what's wrong with you. You know, initially it's very hard to kind of understand whether this, especially with your first child, you know, a lot of the things associated with sleep deprivation and things like that, you know, the anxiety that you feel with a new baby, all of those feelings are quite new to you. And so and that's, I think, why the so many women don't get diagnosed for so long with postnatal depression.
I guess you don't know what's normal, do you?
Exactly.
Because, you know, you've never been through something as life-changing as having a child before. And I suppose as well, it's interesting you say people often say the wrong thing. Oh, you know, this is your dream come true, kind of piling on that pressure. Mm-hmm. And do you think that maybe that is part of the problem, that in society we have an unrealistic expectation, perhaps at times, of what becoming a new parent is really like? And you look at the glossy magazines and you see the celebrities back in their size 8 jeans, and you see them say, oh, it's just so fantastic, and I'm an earth mother, and it's all come so naturally. And if it's not coming that naturally to you, you can feel like a bit of a failure.
Absolutely. And I think that is one of the things that, now having a 4-year-old, I've certainly learnt, is that whatever I do is normal, and whatever I choose to do with regards to my parenting is okay, because it's my child. And, you know, and I think the noise associated with, like, the media and friends and people's opinions and things become less important to you. But as a new mum, in those first couple of months, you know, that's all that you've relied on, these books, these magazines, like you say, with all these glossy pictures, and you're sitting there with, you know, I mean, I didn't realise, for example, when I breastfed, that when you put the baby on one boob to feed, that milk came out the other boob. I didn't know that. And so I was
What's going on?
What's happened to my body?
I've got a leak.
And, you know, because nobody had said about that. And like breastfeeding in itself, you know, that is so hard.
I know.
So hard.
And they always tell you with breastfeeding, oh, if you're doing it properly, it won't hurt.
Yeah.
So I remember in those early days, I was in agony, thinking, well, I must be doing something wrong. But actually, I wish they'd just be truthful and say, it might well hurt, but stick with it, and then it will get better. Rather than trying to tell you that it's just not going to hurt at all, ever. Not true, people, not true.
Absolutely, and people's boobs are different shapes as well.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's different ways of holding them, there's different things, you know, and it's kind of like, I know if I ever had a second child, things would be a lot different.
Yeah.
But
it's finding what works for you.
Exactly, absolutely.
And as you say, when you do have a child, everybody has an opinion. Mm-hmm. From the lady who you don't know at the bus stop, from your mother-in-law, your own mother, friends. And it is very hard, I think, no matter how hard you try, not to compare yourself with other parents, and not to compare your children with other children.
Absolutely. And and I think that the way, you know, even from the health visitors and the midwives that you see, you know, the charts that they're comparing the babies to, and, you know, that there is so much expectation about what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing, how things are, and you know, so much pressure and so many gadgets and stuff now available, you know, and even more so now. I was talking to a new mum, and you know, she was showing me this latest thing, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, that wasn't around. And
you know what I saw though the other day? I thought, what a waste of money. This was a baby wipe heater.
Oh, I've seen that.
Something to heat your baby wipes with. Come on now. I mean, talk about manipulating new parents.
It's crazy.
Just exploitation. Give us your money. Give us your money.
And actually, when you think about it, they do scream when you put a cold wipe on their bottom. So I can see how they actually made that. But whether you need it or not,
no, no, I don't think so.
Up. Suck it up, yeah.
I would say. Really. And it's interesting you talk about the health visitors. Did you feel in those early days that you were able to talk to a healthcare professional about how you were feeling or not?
I was really lucky. I had a great health visitor, and she was very key in listening to me talk. One of the things that I'm really passionate and why I talk about it so freely now is because what helped me get better and helped me in my recovery is talking. And there aren't many people that want to talk about it. And the health visitor I had a really close eye on me, a really close eye on Albie. And it was helpful. And I also was very lucky enough to have a very good doctor that understood and was helpful. And I had an amazing bunch of my close friends, my NCT friends that I met at the NCT group, who were, you know, just essential in my recovery, really. being honest with them and saying, you know, I got diagnosed, you know, I'm the one in six that suffer with postnatal depression.
And is that what it is, 1 in 6?
Mm.
Just that in itself means that there must be a lot of people out there who are suffering this in silence.
Absolutely. And I did a talk recently at an NCT group, and, you know, and I was sitting there and I said, you know, some of you will be suffering, some of you will have been just diagnosed, you know, I'm not going to ask you to hold your hand up or anything, but I'm going to say it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to say, yes, you know, I'm here and I have postnatal depression. There's nothing shameful. It's a chemical in your brain that is missing. That's all it is, and it will come back. Mm. And I was so surprised from talking about it and talking about it recently with other people that suffer with postnatal depression, how similar it was. And I could see that it is an illness. You know, it has similarities. When people talk about it, there are similar things that happen. So although it doesn't feel like it at the time, it is a recognised illness. It is something wrong.
And yet with other illnesses, you know, we'd be more than happy to tell people, and we wouldn't worry about people's reaction. You know, if I were to tell you I was suffering from a kidney infection, you'd be, oh, you poor thing.
Yeah.
But then to say, actually, I'm suffering from postnatal depression or any mental health illness, I would think twice. And I don't think I'm the only one. And it's because of that. It's because, wrongly so, that feeling that people are going to judge you and that they're going to think less of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the one thing that I really appreciate now is my mental health, and something that I'm very passionate that my son is aware of. You know, there is a lot of people talk about our physical health and well-being. You know, and we're very aware of getting enough exercise and, you know, putting the right things in our body to fuel our day. But when was the last time that we stopped and thought about our mental health, which is just as important, and I think even more so in this crazy busy world that we are living in. You know, our children in 20 years time, you know, what is the social media and everything else, what's that going to be like? So I think it's really important to look after our mental health and to pay attention to it and to think, okay, you know, this isn't going quite how I imagined it. So how can, you know, what kind of help is out there? What can I do? And it is something that you have to work on. Mm. Like you have to go, you know, and do exercise to increase your physical health. It is something that you have to pay attention to.
Mm. So what happened with you then? At what point after Albie's birth did you realise that something wasn't quite right?
It was pretty much immediately.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One particular thing I can remember, we have 9 years of fertility treatment, so it was kind of, Albie was a long time coming, a lot of people were involved in, you know, the pregnancy, and I was kept a close eye on. I had a particularly kind of difficult pregnancy as well, and so he was born by a C-section. He was 36 weeks, and so it was planned and we knew, and so it was all very, that was odd in itself. And the first time that I realised that there was something wrong was that I think it was about 8 hours after he was born, I was lying in bed, kind of C-section, kind of tubes mess kind of going on, and my parents, who are hugely supportive of my recovery and hugely supportive of me and, you know, everything I've been doing, my mum was sitting there holding Albie for the first time and crying, and I just remember looking at her thinking, what on earth is she crying about? Didn't get it, you know. Why is she crying?
I didn't, that feeling of being totally detached.
Mm. Yes, and not understanding people's responses, which, you know, it sounds funny now, but it really wasn't, you know. And it's quite a painful memory, really, to kind of think that I was that detached from him, that I couldn't understand what the fuss was about. So yeah.
But as you say, you were ill, so don't beat yourself up about
Absolutely.
But it's interesting you mentioned the fertility treatment. Mm-hmm. I'm no psychologist, but do you think that sometimes, not in all cases, but sometimes when the baby has been so longed for, and you've spent so long thinking this might not happen, that actually when it does happen, there's even a greater sense of pressure? I mean, I had fertility treatment for my children, and I remember, you know, late at night when Harry would be screaming and I would be feeling at the end of my tether and thinking, oh gosh, I can't cope. Yeah. Then I would feel so guilty that I'd even had that thought.
Absolutely.
You ungrateful woman. Mm. This is what you wanted for so long. How can you now feel any sort of negative emotion whatsoever? And I used to beat myself up about that.
Mm. Yeah, totally agree with that. I think there's, and that was a lot of the reasons, and you know, a couple of my friends I've lost contact with, because at the time I didn't want to see them, because I didn't want them to think that I was being ungrateful by not having those feelings and not wanting him. I think after the fertility treatment, you know, I never got past in my head. I never got past the positive pregnancy test. You know, that's all we were, let alone being pregnant. You know? And after 9 years of, you know, miscarriages, the treatment that you go through, the pressure that you put not only on your body, but your emotions as well.
So traumatic.
I think with the fertility treatment, it's trying to find the balance, because the balance between hope and the statistics that are thrown at you, and trying to balance your emotions, because you can't get too attached to it. And I think it was very much a process, and I think that's how we got through the, you know, the IVF, the IUI that we had, was looking at it like a process. Okay, well, next week we've got the injections, next week we've got this, we've got to do this. And so of course, once we had the baby, it was like, okay, well, this is just another process then, you know. And again, it was very hard to attach any emotion to it. Mm. Because we had to detach our emotions from the fertility treatment. So I think that's got possibly something to do with it as well.
And maybe there's an element of trying to protect yourself. You know, maybe in a way you can't almost believe that actually you have this baby that you've longed for so long. Mm. But, you know, having had miscarriages and what have you in the past, maybe there's that sense of, I don't want to get too close, because you just never know what's around the corner.
Absolutely. And my best friend, actually, who I just had a conversation with, she said, I remember, and I don't remember this conversation, she said, I can remember ringing you after you've just had Albie in hospital, and I actually said to her, oh, they're going to come and take him away. I think they've got the wrong person. I don't think he's mine, you know, and I think they're going to come, and someone's going to come and take him away from me. And it is that kind of, and I don't remember that conversation at all, but it obviously has stuck with her. And there is that too good to be true kind of sense about it all. And that wanting and that longing, it's very hard when it's filled. And even now, you know, I'm grateful for him every day, because I do remember sitting in that waiting room with all of those women having that treatment. And, you know, I don't know what the statistics were in that waiting room, but I can imagine there are quite a few women at this stage that probably remember me from that waiting room, and, you know, that they are, you know, still without their baby. I think my mum and my husband at the time, I think they knew something wasn't quite right, and I can actually, the other other thing that I have, I had one of those little flip videos at the time to kind of capture everything. And it was just over Christmas, so my family were down, and I went round with the video camera and I asked everybody, what do you think of Albie? Because I was trying to kind of work out how what I thought, so I was trying to ask other people's opinions about what they thought, and thinking, okay, well, why don't I think that, you know. It's really odd, like I was interviewing them, you know, how do you feel about it, you know, what do you think? So yes, but all I can explain it is that because I also have a dog as well, George, and I can remember going to the doctors and saying, when I look at my dog, I think, oh, you know, that you get that, you want to squeeze his cheeks, you know, that real rush of love. And I said, and I look at Albie, and there's just nothing. There's nothing. And you know, it's I cared for him, I looked after him, and I can remember that being quite a conversation I used to have with a lot of health visitors and a lot of doctors. You know, they used to say to me, right, you know, through the tears and everything else, you say, Mary, you know, do you feel capable? Are you washing him? Are you looking after him? Are you feeding him? And I'd be like, yes, I'm doing all of that. And now I realise what they were doing. They were checking that the basics were there, and, yeah, and the fundamental of caring for a child.
But that, I think, is the greatest fear of women suffering with postnatal depression, that if you tell somebody, they're going to take your baby away. Mm. They're going to think that you're not able, yeah, to care
absolutely.
For them.
And I think that's you know, that's a real big fear, you know. And all I can say is that it's okay, and the best thing that you can do is talk to somebody, whether that's your doctor, whether that's your health visitor. This is normal. It's normal. You know, it's normal to feel like that, and it doesn't last forever. It does get better, but talking about it is what works.
How did all of this affect your marriage? I know you're no longer with your husband.
Yeah.
Was the postnatal depression a factor in that?
Absolutely, yes, very much so. I think I put particular attention on the on feeding, because that was the one thing that I could do for him that no one else could. so that's how I felt useful as a mother. But we did do bottle feeding as well. So, but I kind of put massive pressure on myself to continue with the breastfeeding and to be always breastfeeding. And so I used that as an excuse not to go out, not to leave him. I didn't want to leave him with anybody. And I think that sometimes with the care, and certainly the feedback that I've given to the health visitors and my doctor's surgery, is that the care that there's the talking therapy that was offered was the counselling, but you couldn't take your baby with you. So even though that they're at that stage where,
yeah,
they don't really do a lot, you know, you might have to feed them, but they're in the buggy, so that you'd had to have arranged childcare. And I wasn't ready to leave Albie till he was about a year.
That's a crazy situation, isn't it?
Yeah. So antidepressants were offered and counselling, but the counselling was on, you know, the provision that you didn't have the baby with you.
Now, some people might find that surprising, that you didn't want to leave him, because on the one hand, you're saying you didn't feel this overwhelming, yeah, love for him, but also you didn't want anyone else to look after him.
Yeah, it was very, and that was how it was for me. I just couldn't leave him with anybody. The only person I could leave him with was my husband at the time. And I just, he had reflux and colic. There were lots of other things going on. So
not the easiest.
Not the
of
easiest
babies.
Of babies, right. No. And I just didn't. I thought that I knew how to deal with it, and that no one else would. Mm. And there was that fear of, if I let him go for a night, then, you know, he might go for a longer period of time, and it was that sense, I don't want to lose him or let go of him, so I'll just keep him really close to me. I used to carry him in a sling a lot, and hold him a lot, which again was something that was judged a lot. You know, you can put him down, you know, you're making a rod for your own back,
oh,
if you,
yeah,
don't let him down, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, which I kind of ignored. And, you know, I wanted to have him close to me. And actually, that was the best thing, because, you know, having him close to me, breastfeeding, all of those things, they do build the connection, that touching. And
And they help you bond.
And they help you bond. And now the relationship I have with Albie, it's very cuddly. It's very close. And one of the ways that we kind of, because my ex, when he has looks after Albie for a couple of days or whatever, when he would come back, we have a bath together, because it is that skin on skin contact. It's that way of immediately reconnecting together. Yeah, so it's really important. I think I pretty much straight away, right, I was aware of postnatal depression, and certainly it's something that's talked about when you have IVF. There's a long list of this could happen, you know, before you sign the papers and say yes, we're going to do this. You know, all the statistics show that there's massive increase in divorce, in relationships, you know, ending. There's an increase in postnatal depression because of the hormones and, you know, the feelings that you have during fertility treatment.
Is that true, an increase in divorce after IVF?
Yeah.
I didn't know
that. Yeah, gosh. So, yes, in because there's so much pressure on the relationship. And so it was like we were ticking boxes. So it's like, right, postnatal depression, dick.
Great, you still went ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, so it had a massive impact on our relationship as well, because he was very understanding and trying to understand, but trying to live with somebody with a mental illness is really tough. It's really hard, and especially for men, because I think they... it's a bit of a stereotype, but it is true in my case, is that they're not so ready to talk about emotions. And yes, he comforted me and he realised that I was ill, but it's when you're faced with it 24 hours a day, you do lose patience with it. You do think, come on, you know. And there is that bit
dreaded
of
line, pull yourself together.
Yes, exactly. Mm. And I think pull yourself together should be banned from the English language, full stop. I don't think whether you've got depression or not, it's not what you want to hear, is it?
Not at all.
Because if it was that simple, then it would be done, you know. And it, you know, it is an illness, and it's not as simple as pull yourself together and get on with it.
What was your lowest point? Is there one kind of moment that really stands out for you?
I think the lowest moment or the most difficult for me was going to, because I was encouraged by the health visitor to do baby massage and kind of go to a play group, you know, like a music group and things like that. And I can remember the first time going to a music group, and we had all these little babies on the towels, you know, maracas and stuff, and looking around, and there were mothers going, oh, good, goo, good, goo, you know, talking to their babies. And I was thinking, how are they doing that? How do they know what to say? And what do you do? And I thought, I don't know any nursery, you know, I can't think of anything to sing to him or to say to him. How do you communicate with them? And I can remember thinking, my goodness, this is, you know, I am ill because I cannot understand what's going on around me, and I cannot understand how they can be talking to the babies like that. But I'm surrounded by it, so that must be normal, and I must be very ill to not be able to do that. So,
bless you. Yeah. So how did you recover?
It is purely, you know, people won't want to hear this, and I wouldn't have wanted to hear it, but it is a time thing. You know, it is, you know, you just slowly realise, oh, goodness, yeah, today's been a good day.
Are you recovered now?
I still have clinical depression, so I'm still recovering. So they don't call it postnatal depression anymore. So I still have depression. So I manage that. I'm on a low dose of antidepressants, and I have counselling. I've just finished a course of counselling.
Has that helped?
Really helped, yes, at the Brighton Women's Centre, which is just a fantastic place, and so safe and welcoming, and women, you know, talking to other women about, you know, the tough stuff. I think it's definitely, somebody told me to keep a diary Which is painful to look back at now, and to put a smiley face when I had a good day, and to put a sad face when I didn't have such a good day. And so there were lots of kind of great big sad faces. And but then, you know, it did let me focus on the positive, because when I did write a happy face, I was like, okay, what did I do today? And what I noticed was that all the happy faces were when I saw people, when I talked to people, when I went out and actually, you know, talked to my friends and things. So I just did more of the stuff
that made you happy.
That made me happy.
And maybe that is part of it as well. New mums can at times feel very isolated. Mm. You know, if you are at home on your own all day with a baby, you know, it can get quite lonely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all day with a four-year-old now.
Yeah,
you're pulling your hair out, yeah. Aren't you? Yeah. So I think getting out there and doing stuff, and it doesn't need to cost a lot of money. You know, the library, for example, it was a huge feature in my... It's baby things and
baby boogie. I remember boogie, it well.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you kind of get over the grubby floor and the reconstituted raisins and things like that they're putting in their mouth. You're just thinking, oh, I'm over whatever, it. I mean, yeah. Whatever. And I just smiling at people and just trying to connect with them. And it's the hardest thing to do, but also there are so many mums out there that will go, me too, I'm, you know, and if you're not happy, if you're not comfortable talking about postnatal depression, you know, you have the babies, you know, that one will be having a strange colour poo, so talk about poo. That's that's a common thread,
it's
isn't
a
it?
Common denominator. It bonds people
bonds
together.
Bonds people together, yes. No. So I think there was the odd case of anxiety, but I don't think that's unusual in this day and age to suffer with anxiety.
More unusual to find somebody who doesn't,
yes,
I would say.
Absolutely. And I just think it is something that will always be there, and there will just be more good days than bad at the moment. But I'm working, you know, there's a it was like this very sad story, you know, and when I tell it, you know, people go, oh my goodness, and now you're a single mother. And I'm like, yes, but this is a good thing, you know, I'm in charge.
And you're sat here in front of me smiling, absolutely. So it can't all be bad.
No, absolutely not.
There is a happy ending.
Absolutely.
And now you're really focused on trying to help other people as well, aren't you?
Yes, and that's why I'm here, because like I said to you when we were chatting earlier, I used to spend hours Googling what will fix my postnatal depression Brighton. And that's why I've started a YouTube channel. So I'm doing some vlogging, and I'm talking about things that I did one yesterday in the Pavilion Gardens about getting into a resourceful state. So just getting yourself together, and just spending a few minutes doing that every morning. Things that help, little things, and things that don't cost money, things that are, you know, available to everybody, but it's having the intention of doing it.
Like what little things?
Just being grateful. I think everybody's kind of heard of these gratitude lists and things, and it sounds a bit woo-woo, but it's really simple. And sometimes, some mornings, you know, all I can think of is, I'm really thankful for coffee. I'm so yeah. tired, I'm really grateful for coffee. Yeah, we've got a lot of good coffee in Brighton to be grateful for, haven't we? But like this morning, it was a frosty morning, I was really grateful that I had central heating. At the touch of a button, you know, that we can have a warm, cozy house. And just thinking, changing our view. It's very easy to wake up and think, oh God, it's freezing, or oh goodness, it's raining. You know, that's going to be, you know, rain is just a mother's worst nightmare, isn't it? You know, rain covers, welly boots, puddle, you know, it makes you feel, ugh, doesn't it?
And, yeah, well, and the kids go to, crazy, because you've got to run them out like dogs, haven't you, sometimes,
exactly.
I think. And it's
yeah.
raining, you can't
yeah,
always
no,
do that.
Exactly. And just even doing that is putting your brain and your mind in a negative sense, you know, and so it's very easy to look at things negatively. Whereas if we're grateful for things and we start our mornings in a positive way, being grateful just for one thing, whether it's your warm house, your cozy bed, you know, coffee, just find one little thing. Or at the end of the day, thinking, right, that was a really horrible day, you know, this happened, it couldn't have gone any worse, you know, just one of those days. Try and find one little thing, one tiny little thing that went right or that felt good. And also asking yourself the question, what do I want? Okay. I think that that is the one question, certainly as women, that we, everyone else's needs are kind of louder and bigger than ours. And that's what's so hard about being a mother. You know, you're constantly being shouted at for this, you know, I need my Lego man, you know, I can't go anywhere without this. That's what I had this morning.
You chopped my sandwiches. Yeah, you sliced my sandwiches into triangles. I wanted squares, things like that. The big issues of life.
Absolutely. Or there is, or wanting to get rid of my shadow, which I had this morning. Shadow won't go away.
Mine can do a lot, but that's probably a step beyond.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so you're a life coach now.
I am, yes, yes.
Now, what is a life coach? Because there seems to be an awful lot of them in Brighton. And I think you used the phrase woo-woo earlier. I think for a lot of people, they will think life coach, life coach. What's all that about? We didn't have life coaches 20 years ago. Why do we need them now?
Absolutely. And one of... so a life coach is somebody that helps